Hi, so I'm Stefan Savage from UC San Diego. And so Vern asked me, actually technically Vern asked Kirill Levchenko to come and give a talk about Bitcoin and cybercrime, which he happens to know we were doing some work in. And Kirill couldn't make it, so I was volunteered to give it in his stead. And so I will say that you know, I am kind of like the Zelig of this research. For those of you old enough to have seen old Woody Allen movies, all of the work was done by this fine group of graduate and undergraduate students and researchers, and I was present at the time that this work was done, and we'll tell you about it. Now, the goal here is to give people some, for those of you who first are not up to date on exactly what Bitcoin is, I'm going to give you kind of a little primer on what the hell the Bitcoin thing is, and then all the various ways that it touches on the cybercrime ecosystem. And in the interests of making this more workshop-like, I'm going to encourage people with the session chair's permission to just like raise your hand and shout out questions as you have them instead of holding them to the end, because I'm going to cover a lot of different things. All right. So first of all, what the hell is Bitcoin? If you haven't been under a rock, it is this purely online currency and payment system. So that's important. Those are two different things. It is not only a payment system. We have lots of payment systems. PayPal is a payment system that affects money transfer in different currencies, but they're valued in dollars or in euros or whatever. Bitcoin is valued in Bitcoin. You get a Bitcoin that is subdivided into Satoshi. I mean, it is a currency in and of itself. It is backed by no one. It has no commodity behind it. It has no standing of a government behind it. It is generated entirely computationally, exists only online in the minds of a bunch of computers that are talking to one another. Which, if you think about it, is not that different from real-life currency, except that they have a government standing behind them. This has a bunch of guys on an internet forum standing behind it, and a very motivated community. I mean, one of the first Bitcoin conferences kicked off and there were gazillions of people and venture showing up and startups, and people have like watches that will store your Bitcoin. I mean, it's mad. All right. So Bitcoin is also completely decentralized. And this is perhaps the most important thing to recognize about Bitcoin. There is no central banker. There is no singular person who has any special authority in the Bitcoin network that you can go to and say, who has how much money? All right, so it is achieved. Instead, there is a distributed ledger that everyone has. So it is as though everyone has to maintain the bank accounts of everyone else. And that is actually, it's not as though, that is what happens. So if you participate in the Bitcoin network today, you have a 3 gigabyte file of every transaction that has ever happened in Bitcoin. You have to, there's no choice. And this has a number of implications in the design, as well as one of the things that makes it, you know, somewhat more secure. It's also pseudonymous, so Bitcoin wallets, which are the things that hold value, are just public keys. They are not fundamentally tied to any kind of PII. They're very cheap to create. You can invent one like that. But they don't have an address, they don't have a name, they don't have any other identifier information associated with them. And then important for merchants and for criminals is that transactions in the Bitcoin network are fundamentally irreversible. There is no notion of saying, whoopsie, we're going to reverse that transaction. It cannot be done. You can do another transaction, transferring money back, but once a transaction is over, the value has moved, it is gone. All right, and then most important, people are actually using this stuff, all right? There is some traction with this Bitcoin. So just as an aside, this is a picture from a paper we have appearing in IMC. We went and bought a whole bunch of stuff. This is a subset with Bitcoin, and you want to buy a Guy Fawkes mask or some silver quarters or some Magic the Gathering cards or some cupcakes from San Francisco, you can buy it entirely in Bitcoin and have it shipped to you. So we have a room table full of crap we bought from Bitcoin, and you can buy MP3s and videos and, you know, copying services. There's lots of stuff that you can buy, in fact, in Bitcoin. And in fact, I'll get to Silk Road. Calm yourself. Always going for the salacious stuff, Mr. Rick Farrow. All right. There are also real life companies that you've heard of, not Cupcake, San Francisco Cupcake Company, but like you go to WordPress, if you want to buy extensions for, plugins for your blog, you can use a credit card, PayPal, or they accept Bitcoin. And so they're increasing, and part of this is that there are now services like BitPay that will, if you want to be a merchant and take Bitcoin and not have to know a goddamn thing about Bitcoin or worry about volatility or any of that, they will absorb all of that for you. You just say, here's how much my thing costs in dollars, and make it happen in Bitcoin, and they take care of it, and they charge you a fee. All right. The final reason why we care about Bitcoin is because it went from, in its value against other currencies, it went from like nothing, like $5 in 2012, and it rocketed up in value against other currencies. So at its peak, it was about $220 per Bitcoin. It's now down to about $100, but you can see that there's a log scale, by the way, on the y-axis. Time is on the x-axis. That there's this huge ramp up in perceived value of Bitcoin versus fiat currencies, and this holds for the euro and so forth. You can also see there's a fair amount of volatility, which is one of the challenges as both a merchant and as a criminal in using Bitcoin, because how much money you have can vary significantly from hour to hour when these kinds of processes are going on. But that's not unique to Bitcoin. It was also true of, you know, the lira in, you know, post-World War II Italy. So, all right, so quickly, I'm going to explain how Bitcoin works in theory. Don't ask hard questions here, because I can't answer like which elliptic curve they use. I don't know. And then I'll just briefly say, how would you use this in practice as Joe Schmo trying to use Bitcoin? And then we'll talk about the criminal part. All right, so what's a Bitcoin? So a Bitcoin, in fact, is a chain of transactions. All right, it is not a single thing. It is a record of a set of transactions from when it was first created until it got into your hands. All right, so every Bitcoin transaction has inputs on the left side and outputs on the right side, and you can have a variable number. So we start in the beginning of time. There is magic that happens here on the left-hand side. Poof, a Bitcoin is created through magic that we'll talk about later into thin air, and it is put over there. There's some like thing, hex numbers, that's a hash of a public key. And so 25 point something Bitcoins was deposited in that public key. And so in that transaction, it goes from, you know, the Big Bang into a Bitcoin wallet. Later on, that money is spent, and it appears on the left-hand side of another transaction. It is combined with another input, also of roughly 25 Bitcoin. And in this other transaction, there are two other outputs, one for half a Bitcoin, the other for 50. This shows that you, in a transaction, you can add, in every transaction, everything on the left-hand side is spent in its entirety, but on the right-hand side, you can divvy things up into different public keys. And so there's 50 Bitcoin in one and half in another, and then some of it gets put in a third one and so forth. And so at the end, you will have, this is a hash of a public key, so the owner of that address, if they want to spend the 1.17 Bitcoins that is in that address, they basically cons up this whole record. And they say, here is the proof that I have this whole chain of transactions going back to this event when the Bitcoin was first created. And that's, in fact, what happens. Now, there is some shorthand, because everyone keeps a copy of all the blocks and so forth, but this is effectively what you're doing. You are showing the entire transaction history. It is as though when you wanted to spend a gold coin, you kept a record of its provenance going back to when it was first mined out of the ground. All right, that is what a Bitcoin is. All right, yes?
Hopefully not to rip your own. Doesn't it sound like it's going to exponentially explode? You know, Bitcoins are going to be so large.
Well, this is only relative to the creation of a coin, and we create new coins over time. But it is the case, you're right, that this ledger of coins being created is getting bigger rather quickly. They understand this, and they have a bunch of reasonable solutions for transaction rates that you could possibly expect under Bitcoin's extreme success. So yes, you're right, but it's probably handleable. It may create some new security problems the way they handle it, but so the reason it is this way is because there is no trusted party to maintain a general ledger. All right? Because everyone needs to be able to validate that you really have a Bitcoin, and they need to be able to go back and say, well, why should I believe that? There's no one who can attest to it. Everyone needs to be able to see the total ground truth. All right, so a transaction is basically a way that you move Bitcoins from one public key to the other, and is effectively a statement that you say, I own these Bitcoins, and I'm giving them to this other public key. And I'm going to just go over this really, really briefly. This is Sarah put this together, who actually understands this stuff. But basically, you'll take the previous transaction in the chain, and you sign it along with using the secret key for the wallet that you own, along with the public key of the intended recipient. And so you do your current transaction, the previous transaction, and then the recipient can verify with their own copy of all this information that you actually own all this stuff. All right. Then finally, and all transactions are effectively broadcast. So if you are on the Bitcoin network as a first-class entity, you are hearing about everyone, like Joe Schmo wants to buy some cupcakes. Yeah, you get that. Everyone gets that. In fact, they have to get that. All right, so how do the coins get generated? Remember, yes?
Is there a timestamp on the transaction?
Yeah, there's a timestamp. I mean, and the timestamp is not time per se. It has to do with this thing called the blockchain that I'm going to gloss over in a second. All right? So there's no one issuing these Bitcoins, so how do they get created to begin with? Well, there's a process called mining. And mining basically is there is some agreement of a computational puzzle, in this particular case, finding SHA-256 collisions in a particular space, that have a particular number of zeros at the end, and how many zeros gets adapted by agreement in response to how much hashing everyone is doing. So how much computational ability there is in the network. And this is to prevent, this is basically to normalize how much work you need to do to create new Bitcoin as a function of how much computational ability exists in the whole network over time. And so it is normalized so that one of these hashes that will create what's called a block gets created every 10 minutes. And then there's some magic reward. Right now, it's 25 bitcoins if you find this block. So every 10 minutes, 25 bitcoins get mined in a block. It used to be 50. In a few years, it'll be 12.5. And this is done on a fixed schedule that will ensure that asymptotically the total monetary supply of Bitcoin is 21 million. There'll never be more than 21 million bitcoins. You can slice them down like to millionths of a bitcoin. I think that's a Satoshi. There'll never be more than this. All right. Now mining, in fact, the important part of mining isn't just that it's hard to do. This is how you actually effectively make transactions stable. So when everyone is sending these transactions saying, I want to buy a cupcake, when you're mining, you gather all the outstanding transactions, and that's what you shove together in this message that you're doing these SHA-256 hashes on. So once you find this thing, the act of mining a block effectively makes a statement that says, all right, I solved this hard puzzle, and I included in it all these outstanding transactions. That makes these transactions permanent, and everyone takes these mined blocks, and they keep them in their database of 3 gigabytes, and that's what makes it, and then the blocks depend on all the previous blocks, and that's what makes it hard for someone to fake one of these things, because it is now dependent on all of this past hard computational work. All right, so really quick summary. You have a blockchain, every block that's been mined. A block is just a collection of outstanding transactions whose hash is in a particular range. A transaction is just a collection of these elliptic curve signatures that say, I'm going to transfer money from one public key to another public key. And then an individual Bitcoin is a chain of transactions tracing from the moment a Bitcoin was created in the block that got a reward all the way to its current public key owner. It's somewhat complicated, but in reality, if you use it, you don't have to know about most of this stuff. So you will go to an exchange, like Mt. Gox said, I'd like to buy some Bitcoin, and you pay them in dollars or euro or what have you, and they will give you something. You can then withdraw it to an address you own if you don't want to keep it with them. Then you can spend it. Usually there's an interface where you just basically cut and paste one of these big long strings, and that arranges payment to be made. All right? So you don't actually need to know most of the details if you're just a user or if you're a merchant. All right, for criminals, the number of possibilities here. One, Bitcoin offers a means to accept consumer payment because credit cards have taken a lot of pressure of late. And so if they would like to accept consumer payment without the intervention from governments or big business, Bitcoin provides an alternative. Direct wealth creation, otherwise known as theft. We'll talk about a couple of means of doing that. And then Bitcoin is somewhat attractive as a means for criminals to pay one another because there's no central authority who's going to get shut down. They're somewhat anonymous and so forth. All right. So in principle, Bitcoin would be a great way to deal with consumer payments because it's very hard to shut down because there is no central authority. The problem is it's a real pain in the ass to use because the user gets like, please take this hash value and cut and paste it into a window and so forth, and they have no idea what that is, and it's confusing and so forth. So what ends up happening is that the markets that actually use Bitcoin tend to fall into these two categories. They're highly motivated markets. Markets full of dyed-in-the-wool Bitcoin believers, which tends to be, kind of extreme libertarian, the Austrian school is right, fractional reserve banking is the devil, that kind of thing. And it serves that ecosystem. Or goods with very high legal risk. And so here we go, Silk Road. So if you want to buy, if you want to buy ecstasy, or Brian Krebs just had someone buy him a bunch of heroin on Silk Road that was sent to him, the Bitcoin is a pretty convenient currency for buying things that are just patently illegal because you don't have to worry as much about it being shut down or you being tracked. Remember, in all of this Bitcoin stuff, the thing that actually allows you to declare that you have some Bitcoins is simply the possession of this secret key that allows you to do these signatures. So it's only as all of the values in the secret key, if you lose the secret key, that's it. You lose all the value associated with the wallet. And since all transactions are irreversible, you can move this stuff around and there's no way to undo it. There's no one you can appeal to. There's no Bitcoin court of appeal saying, I was defrauded, please undo the last 20 blocks. And so in fact, there are tons of these attacks, both on end users, pieces of malware that'll look for popular wallet software. I think Bitcoin.org just announced today that if you use Android to hold your Bitcoins, you should abandon that immediately because the Android random number generator sucks and all of your Bitcoins are bad. But also exchanges, places that will take Bitcoins and exchange them for other currencies like dollars, have been attacked. And these things get stolen as well. So what a number of exchanges now do as a matter of course is they will have what's called cold store. They will take all the keys, make multiple copies of them, put them on flash drives, and then disconnect them from the internet. Right? So that until that money is needed, it is literally not even powered with electricity. It is just sitting in a safe somewhere. And so in fact, there's tons of these cases where people will steal a few $100,000 in Bitcoin from some exchange. All right, so the one that I find a little, this is undoubtedly my cell phone. The one that I find a little more interesting is the notion of botnet mining. So remember that the way you mine, the create value in Bitcoin is through doing a lot of computational cycles. And so, if you have computes, you can make money now. But the return on these computes is normalized by the global hash rate. How much computational power does everyone in Bitcoin have? And this has been going up pretty significantly from investments in better ways of doing SHA-256, in particular using GPUs and then FPGAs. And now there are a number of companies that sell ASICs that all they do is SHA-256 just for the Bitcoin market. There's more miners. So the global hash rate today is about 35 terahashes per second. It's just a crap load. If only they had picked some useful problem for Bitcoin. Other than SHA, maybe we should be mapping our problem into SHA-256 hashing. All right, so the issue is mining on a commodity PC, which is, let's say, a reasonable PC is about 10 megahashes per second, is just not cost effective because the expected return at current prices against the dollar is about a cent per day, but electricity is going to be about 35 cents per day powering that up. Now, the observation, of course, is that botnets get free electricity, right? They are very, I don't know, they're not green, but they're very cheap. And so the way that my colleague Kirill Lukashenko likes to think about this is that if you are a bot herder, you are trying to use all of the different cuts of the bot, all right? And so we started off with the IP address. Spammers wanted to launder their origin, get use out of that part and monetize that. And then, you know, the individual user has banking credentials, and then maybe I can do some hosting on this for wares, and I can use the storage component. And then for DDoS, I can use the bandwidth component. And sometimes you may use some of these in combination to extract as much value out of the carcass of the bot as you can. But there have been a number of important resources that have been left fallow. And right off the ass is the CPU. No one has really monetized the CPU in a significant way in cybercrime until Bitcoin came along. And so, in fact, there are a whole bunch. We track more than a dozen different significant botnets that just do Bitcoin mining. All right? And so here's one that we call Ferret that's making about $250 a day. It has this telltale diurnal pattern when the machines come on and off. There's about 16,000 low-end PCs doing about 10 mega hashes per second. It is, in general, probably pulling in about $250 a day on an ongoing basis. We found other people who pulled in about $150,000 off of their bot. So each individual one isn't that much, but together this can actually add up to some money. And you could also use, in principle, these bots for other things. Now, here's a really quick, interesting observation. If you look at the makeup of these bots, which we've been able to do with a third-party data set, they are disproportionately from low-valued hosts. That is, like Asian countries, where the market for compromised hosts in those countries is poor. So, you know, typically it's about only 1/10 of the cost of Western hosts. And so, one hypothesis that we have is that what part of what may be going on is that the pricing of the compromised host market has not yet priced in CPU into the value of these hosts. And so, in fact, you can buy Asian host at $5 per thousand. They have, because they're not really good, they don't have, you know, the Chinese hosts don't have credit cards on them. Everyone knows that you should filter spam coming from China to the US in large numbers. So they're not as valuable for the other kinds of things that you would monetize with. But here, at $5 per thousand, you can, in some sense, just print money by doing Bitcoin mining at the current difficulty rate of the network. As long as they live currently about 24, 48 hours and it's profitable. All right, finally, there's intercriminal payments. The advantage of Bitcoin, one, it's somewhat anonymous, it's irreversible. And people like anonymous irreversible payments for things like affiliate program payouts, for if I want to buy malware, because no one wants to tie into a financial system that can track back to them. And traditionally, we've done these with centralized payment systems like eGold and WebMoney and Liberty Reserve. The problem with centralized systems is that it provides a single point of failure. And in fact, these things, you know, eGold got shut down a number of years ago for money laundering. If you've been reading the newspaper over the last year, you heard Liberty Reserve got shut down for money laundering. WebMoney will never get shut down for money laundering because it's politically too sensitive because of its place in Russia. And it gets used for a lot of legitimate business. But the FSB has shown an increasing willingness to track the use of web money transactions, so criminals are not as happy with it as they used to be. Yes?
So by pseudonymous, is the issue there if law enforcement gets your secret key, then they can use that to actually pick up other people's transactions?
No, the issue here, because all the transactions are public, it's just, number two sent to number nine, and number nine then split their money and sent to 13 and 36, and they sent to Frog. I mean, and none of those have any significance. They don't tie back to a real life bank account, a real life address. You can't target a missile at it. You know, it's just, there are things that are happening, but I'm not as concerned about someone finding me in the pseudonymous world. That's the theory.
Okay, so there's a Panopticon, which is like a cap in San Francisco.
Yeah, I'm going to tell you why this is imperfect. All right. So So here's why you might like Bitcoin. Irreversible transactions, because you're dealing with criminals, so they're going to rip you off. So, you know, you don't want something reversible. You like no central authority, because you got totally hosed when Liberty Reserve got taken down, and so you're looking for something else. And you like that your transactions are somewhat anonymous. Now, the problem is that these two are less true. They're kind of true, maybe in principle. They're not quite true in practice. So one issue is that no one really wants Bitcoin, okay? In the end, you want dollars or euros or rubles or something that you can actually go down to the store and buy a Coke with. And that's not Bitcoin today. And so really people want to use all of these things, whether it's e-gold or whatnot, as a laundering vehicle. And for something to be a good laundering vehicle, you need to get stuff in and out of it. And so what we have in the Bitcoin world are exchanges, people that will take fiat currency on one side or another form of e-currency and transfer it into Bitcoin. And the exchanges, as with any market that grows, they end up, you know, the small players get eaten up by the big players. And so there's a small number of exchanges that pretty much dominate the exchange market, of which Mt. Gox is the 500-pound gorilla in the room. And these big guys, because they're big, end up being forced to comply with know your customer rules. So they can be subpoenaed, and then they can, so this, there was a transaction with this public key that you own. Please tell us who then took money out of that. And they have to maintain those records. And if they don't, you can do things like FinCEN has showed a willingness to do, like shut down their ability to transact in dollars anywhere in the world. And that turns out to be a very effective lever. So then the question is, how could I tell from this public key that it was going to Mt. Gox or anything like that? And the problem is that wallets are anonymous-ish until you use one. But if I have like a key and I then buy something from Vern, pay Vern with it, well, Vern now knows that that key is mine because we had some out-of-band thing we did and he saw me use that key. And so it turns out that you can use this to identify all the keys belonging to all the exchanges and all the vendors by a re-identification attack. So you buy a bunch of these keys, you buy a bunch of things or do a bunch of transactions with them, and then it turns out that you can have many different ones for each service, it turns out they can be clustered, and there's details in a paper at IMC that Sarah Michael John et al. Did in terms of how the patterns of how the money gets used and idioms of how the money gets used. So the end result is you can put all this stuff together. This is a map of the entire Bitcoin transactions, I think ever up to about 3 months ago. There's this big thing here. These are extremely low-value gambling transactions, but there's a gazillion of them. This one service called Satoshi Dice. And then over here is this big connected component with Mt. Gox being the largest. This is proportional to the number of transactions. And so most of these guys, in fact, are exchanges, with the exception of Silk Road, which is really the only vendor of any significance. And so there's a lot of money moving around, not necessarily a lot of money being spent. And so we were able to show that for Bitcoin thefts, you can actually use this technique to then track what happens to the money after it being stolen. We looked at a number of big thefts and track it back to exchanges. And at that point, if you had subpoena power, you could go and say, well, who ultimately got dollars out of this transaction? So follow the money works in Bitcoin as well. And it's hard to be anonymous if you want to move money through any system at scale, and Bitcoin isn't really special if you don't want to keep your money in Bitcoin. If you're willing to just sit on it for 20 years and hope that Bitcoin works, and then you could be okay. All right, I'm going to ignore this. All right, so summary. So Bitcoin, it's kind of the first semi-successful distributed online cryptocurrency. Huge market value, over $1 billion at current exchange rates. That value, in turn, attracts a lot of criminal interests, ranging from payment. We find online pharmacies and people selling counterfeit software and so forth in Bitcoin. People stealing it because there's a way to cash out, exploiting your CPU resource in order to create new ones, and then for internal payments. So there's a bunch of different ways. Any new payment scheme ultimately gets absorbed and used and gnawed over by the criminal ecosystem, and Bitcoin is no exception. So with that, I'll take any remaining questions, and thank you very much.
Does Bitcoin do any kind of validation or verification of the public private key, and it's actually a decent one? Or is that just all kind of left out?
That's a so you're the real. I think the essence of the question is, when you generate public-private key pairs, is there some validation that you had good entropy going into that system, and you're not going to have a replica of the recent problems we've seen with embedded systems that Nadia Hensinger and company hunted down? I'm not aware that any of the certainly there's nothing in the protocol that checks that. And I'm not aware that any of the current implementations check that by default. There is this other issue about verifying that a claim is true. So that's one of the interesting things about Bitcoin, is that in a normal, like a bank transaction, you make it and then the bank signs it and then it's done. Like the bank certifies that it's true. In Bitcoin, you put it out there, someone puts it in a block, and then like, Are you sure that's true? Really, you want a bunch of other people to agree to that chain of information. You can think of this as shared belief. And so there's this rule of thumb that says, well, you should really rate for 10 confirmations, which basically means, and if you're waiting for a block to be mined, it means you're going to wait for about 10 minutes for a transaction to complete. And you can imagine how frustrated you're going to be on Amazon buying something and then waiting 10 minutes to find out if they agreed that you had that purchase. So there is this magic wiggle room that goes on. And so what a lot of these middlemen companies do is they front that risk during while the network is coming to agree to whether this thing happened. And there are some attacks that I didn't go into that have happened where double spending will happen in that window where one, yeah. Yes?
Are you aware of law enforcement actually trying to do this kind of tracking, in the sense that it seems like, you know, since it's really easy to say, okay, let's say Harry will exchange money instead of say, bro, why isn't the DEA doing this, or are they doing this?
To the best of my knowledge, the DEA is not doing this. I will say that we have definitely been talking with people in government about doing this. Here's what I would say. I do not believe, in my opinion, that they are doing this. They are interested in being able to do this, and they are happy that it could be done. And I think that's as much as is going on. Yes?
So just to make sure I understand, if I were to purchase something from, say, Silk Road, I know my own public key.
Yes.
So I'm seeing the transaction, my public key, timestamp, and then the public key of someone. And I would presume that public key is now Silk Road, right?
That the public key that you were making this purchase from, by definition, has to be Silk Road's at that time because you're transferring value to them. They're going to give it to you. They're going to say, send money to this public key, whoever the merchant that you're buying from is.
I know who they are.
Yeah.
And so anonymity is just gone.
Well, Silk Road is interesting because Silk Road has a mix that they run. All right? And so yes, they have this public key, but then they also do arrange to have a mix where they'll take a bunch of other transactions in and do exchanges between them. And so at that point, it becomes somewhat less clear, you know, which output corresponds to the input.
Okay. Well, I guess what I'm trying to get to in my question is that considering that scalability becomes a bit of a anonymity becomes a bit of an issue, and volatility of the price becomes a major issue, it starts to become questionable the value to a libertarian set.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it starts to become less and less valuable there, and sort of like, what's even the point to anyone other than a criminal?
I can't speak on behalf of the rabid libertarian set. But there are certainly people who I'm sure who like Bitcoin better than the fiat currency alternatives they have. And there certainly have been, so there's a proposal out of Hopkins called Zerocoin to add some much stronger anonymity properties to Bitcoin. And I should also say, by the way, there are a gazillion other coins. There's Litecoin, Rucoin, whatever coin, and then there are exchanges between them. These are variants of the Bitcoin system that have slightly different properties. So there is a whole lot of innovation going on in this space. Bitcoin is the most successful of the lot. Yes, and then how about one more?
Yeah.
Why not generate one wallet per transaction?
You can create one wallet per transaction. Now, the trick that you have is that you have to, because of the way the protocol works, you spend in your entirety. All right, so suppose I want to buy some, so I have 50 Bitcoin. I want to buy something for 13 Bitcoin. So I need to do a transaction of 13 to one guy, but then the other one needs to be a change wallet that I create for myself. So I can infer that the one that I'm not paying to also belongs to the person on the input side, because that's their change. Right? And then the other thing is, if you do this, you could put lots of money into lots of different wallets, but over time, you get a gazillion different change wallets. And so what ends up happening is, at some point, you take your jar full of you take all your change and you put it in a big jar and you shove it together and make a bigger wallet, because it's not useful to have stuff with a gazillion little pieces. And so you can post facto, this is what we do, post facto tie all these change wallets back together to the same person. All right, with that, I'm happy to take questions offline, but thank you very much.